It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll discuss a new report showing Wisconsin is last in the nation when it comes to the well-being of African-American kids.
First, a respiratory virus called Enterovirus 68 is popping up in at least 12 states around the country, including Illinois and Iowa, with hundreds of children hospitalized so far.
That's got a lot of parents asking, what is this disease? What do we watch out for? Should we be worried here in Wisconsin? Dr. Jonathan Tempty joins us to tackle those questions. He's a family physician and professor of family medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Tempty, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Rob. It's a pleasure to join in today.
So first of all, what's an enterovirus? And am I even saying it right?
Well, pretty close. We term them enteroviruses.
Ah.
And there are a group of viruses that are closely related to something familiar with almost all of us, the common cold viruses or rhinovirus. And as it turns out, that most of our diagnostic tools that we use out there cannot distinguish between enteroviruses and rhinoviruses.
Now, did this enterovirus, is number 68, did it surprise us with this recent flare-up?
Yes and no. This was a virus first characterized and identified back in 1962, so it's been with us for 52 years. But over that time, we just haven't seen much of it. And because of that, we don't have much background information in terms of what to expect when we see it out there. There have just been a few outbreaks in the past.
What is different about this thing, enterovirus number 68, from, say, that common cold that's putting kids in hospitals?
Well, the main thing is the severity that is accompanying this virus. The first notice of something amiss was in Kansas City, reported back in mid-August, with a number of children who were hospitalized with fairly severe respiratory difficulties. They were having trouble getting enough oxygen. And so these children were hospitalized, and some actually ended up requiring a ventilator to help them breathe.
Now, why does this seem to affect kids so much more than adults?
A good question, and the answer is, at this point, we don't know. What I can say, though, is when we get to this time of year, the end of August and early September, when schools start again, we typically see a doubling of the cases of respiratory tract infections we see in our clinics, and this occurs across the country. Kids are really the sources and the modes of transmission of these, so we almost always see more respiratory viruses in children than older people. As it turns out with enterovirus D68, of the cases reported so far to CDC, they've been in the range from 6 weeks of age through 16 years. So we haven't seen anybody older as of yet. However, I must say that this is something that a regular clinic and a regular hospital can't test for. These require high-level tools that are available in only a few labs.
Are we going to see that testing more available now that we've got this flare-up of this illness?
Well, I think the CDC will release the test kits or the test material to various locations across the country, in particular to public health laboratories to help identify what's going on.
Now, given that this illness has been spotted in Illinois, in Iowa, are we likely to see it here in Wisconsin in the near future?
I think the fair answer is a high likelihood that we will. What we will see, though, we don't know. We're not sure if we'll see the same severity or not. We just don't have enough experience with this particular virus. But I think, that being said, people should be on the lookout for illness that is above and beyond what we typically think of the fall time cold.
Right. This is a running conflict for parents. Do I take my kid in? Do I not? Whether we're talking about this enterovirus or other respiratory conditions, what are the symptoms that we should be watching for that say, hey, it's time to get over to a doctor?
Well, first of all, The things to keep in mind is about two-thirds of the children affected with severe breathing problems had underlying asthma. So it seems to have much more problem with those children. As it turns out, of the children that were investigated and from which the virus was identified, almost all of them had significant problems with breathing. So typically, with most colds and most cases of influenza in children, we will see kids look sick, we'll see fevers, we'll see cough, but we rarely see difficulty breathing. So I think the key here is if a child is having difficulty breathing, that's a very good indication to seek medical advice and assistance.
And we, you mentioned the kids with asthma. A child with asthma, probably we set the bar a little lower when we go to seek help from a doctor?
Well, I think we keep that in mind, but we also do everything to make sure that child with asthma is being treated as appropriately as possible. And for kids with asthma, we really think it's important that they be seen once or twice a year just to fine-tune their asthma care. So that's very important. I think across the board, for all children, making sure that they're up to date with their influenza vaccine, and we're back in that season again. The vaccine is available and ready to use, and we don't want to complicate one virus with another viral infection.
Now, one thing I worry about when we in the media cover really any illness, I'm hoping that we're not driving people to emergency rooms unnecessarily. Are there things that parents should just watch and wait and not quickly pull the trigger and get to that emergency room?
Absolutely. At this point in time, my clinic and my research group run a surveillance program here in Dane County. And predominantly, we are seeing rhinovirus right now. And I can assure people that at this point in time, most of what we're seeing are either mild or moderately ill people. But very few with fever, most of them with cough, but really nobody with difficulty breathing. So I think the hallmark here and what should be the trigger with parents is not a cold, not even a fever, but if a child is having difficulty breathing. You know, before we get to that point, you know, we might see wheezing. We might see, in younger children, increased rate of breathing. And those are all things to kind of keep our eye tuned to.
Now, this is a virus. Antibiotics not going to do any good. What's the treatment if a kid goes into the hospital? What do they do?
Well, you're absolutely right there. There is no definitive medication for this. There is no vaccine to prevent this. But if children are having difficulty breathing, there are things that can be done in a hospital setting, from providing supplementary oxygen to even, if need be, providing artificial or respiration through a ventilator. Unfortunately, in the situations both in Kansas City, Missouri, and in Chicago, there have been children that have required at least a short time on a ventilator to maintain their oxygen levels.
Well, we'll keep watching this one. Dr. Tempty, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you very much. Take care now.
That's Dr. Jonathan Tempty. He's a family physician and professor of family medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, talking about this enterovirus that's putting kids in the hospital around the country over the last couple of weeks.
We're talking about a study out today from the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. The study shows Wisconsin is dead last in the nation when it comes to the well-being of African-American children.
We have two guests on this topic today. Ken Taylor, executive director of the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. Ken, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
And Michael Johnson, CEO of the Dane County Boys and Girls Club. Michael, welcome back to you as well.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, Ken, let's start off with a look at this report. What conclusions are we seeing here?
Well, unfortunately, what this report shows, as Ronica said, is that when we look at the well-being of African-American children in Wisconsin, it's the worst in the nation. And not only that, but when we look at the gap between how well and the challenges that African-American children face and how well our white children do, that's the largest gap in the nation.
So Wisconsin's African-American children are doing worse than their African-American peers in other states, their white peers here in Wisconsin.
Exactly.
So well-being, what are we talking about? What are we measuring here?
So this particular study looked at 12 different indicators of well-being, from economics and poverty to how well kids do in school, high school graduation, as well as some health factors. So those were all put together, these 12 factors, to look at this issue.
Now, Michael Johnson, let's bring you on this. We've heard a lot of bits and pieces of this kind of news. Any surprises here in this report for you?
Yeah, no surprises at all. And I actually applaud Ken and his group for putting this report together. One of the things I was sharing with Ken in the lobby, that I think we have to continue to have conversations like this, and it's very, very important. But at some point, I think people are report fatigued. But I'm so glad they put this out today, because if they didn't put it out, you wouldn't have called us today, and all the local radio stations wouldn't be having this conversation today. But how do we as a community begin to look at this data? So what Ken and his group has done is built what we call the business case. So just like in any good business, there's a business plan with smart goals, and that's what's missing statewide. That's what's missing in our county and our municipal governments. Too many African-American, Latino, Asian American and Native American kids are struggling in our communities, and we have to address these issues.
Well, let's take it a piece at a time. We'll have Ken do some of that business case you mentioned, and then Michael, we'll see maybe how we can tackle this. Ken, you mentioned that poverty number. I'm looking at the charts right now. This is one of the most stark disparities. So can you spell out the poverty numbers for us?
Right. So this particular report is limited to 12 indicators, and these are indicators that are comparable across the nation. Our organization put out a more in-depth report last year. Many of your listeners may be familiar with the Race to Equity report, and we can supplement the findings that we have here with additional indicators. But really what this shows is this particular indicator is about 200% of the poverty line, which is still pretty poor. And we find that the vast majority of African-American children and children and other kids of color are poor, whereas that's very much the minority for white kids, which then the stresses that creates on both the kids and the families then has a knock-on effect on lots of the other indicators.
Well, looking at this number, that poverty line you mentioned, white kids, 70% live above that line. Among black children, 22% live above that line. Huge difference.
Huge difference. And again, that's one of the largest gaps between African-Americans and whites in the nation. But it's also not limited to African-American mm-hmm. children. There's many children of color that are struggling as well. But that is the largest gap that we've seen anywhere. And that is one of the reasons why we see the gaps in the other data indicators.
And Michael, I imagine this poverty issue is tied in with a lot of the other things we're going to talk about. But starting on that that poverty issue, what kind of things are we doing, should we be doing to address that huge disparity?
Yeah, I think first, having the conversation is the first step. Second is that our business community, our faith-based community, our nonprofit leaders, the public sector all have to be in one accord in terms of how we address these issues. We have to look at policies. I think there's a lot of people in our state that want to do something around these issues, but they just don't know how to. And so I think that's where Ken Group, my organization, and multiple groups that's out there trying to address these issues. So here's what I would say. If you look at the employment disparity, so right here, I think with the Race to Equity report, so there was a 20-point gap between African Americans and their white counterparts. Is that accurate?
25% unemployment for African Americans in Dane County, 5% unemployment for whites in Dane County.
So you look at that, that's a big gap. So if we want to be serious about this issue, there needs to be a BHAG. I would call it a big, hairy, audacious goal for that one category. So under that BHAG, it should read something like, we will close, we will make sure that African Americans in our state and our county are employed at the same rates of their white counterparts? And then what are the SMART goals that's going to help us get there? I think we need strategies like that to address these issues. The same with the achievement gap. And so if we have kids that are underperforming in our schools in Milwaukee and Madison and Racine, how do we make sure that we put resources in our schools validated by third-party data to make sure that our kids are excelling? And I just think we spend money on the tail end instead of the front end.
And that education issue, that's another big part of your report, Ken. And this is not breaking news. We've been hearing about this for some years now, but that gap is definitely still there.
It certainly is. And it starts early and continues on. So each of the education indicators see significant gaps: fourth grade reading, eighth grade math, high school graduation. But I would say that one of the bright spots in this report, relatively bright — it's not really bright, but relatively bright — is the level of involvement in early care and education. And so we think that it's really important to invest significantly in early care and education when kids' brains are developing, so that we have to take the long-term view. But the way that we're really going to turn around these numbers is by investing in these kids early.
And Michael, you said get at the problem up front. Is that a great place to start? Preschool, before the kids are even in the school system?
Yeah, you got to do it early. You know, so you look at our federal government. They began, when they look at their capital programs, they look at the third grade reading scores of young people all across the country and decide where they want to build prisons. So you look in California, they built 25 new prisons in that state, but they built one new university. There's something wrong with that picture. And Ken talked about the mayor's symposium this morning. You think about we have to make sure that we drive great jobs to this state. So 73% of all jobs that was created in Wisconsin came from Dane County, and 27% of those jobs came from Epic. So how do we get more companies to come here, to bring businesses here, to employ our young people and their families? How do we make sure that our schools have a very strong tax base so we're not pulling resources from them? If the resources are not there, we can come out with reports, we can come out with plans all day, but at the end of the day, if the resources are not targeted to those young people and their families that are struggling, we're going to be talking about these issues in 2045.
Well, Michael, given that we have this constant drumbeat of this bad news coming up again and again, is it catching on? Are people saying, okay, yes, this is a real issue? By people, I mean from communities up to, you know, policymakers.
I'm going to say yes, at least from the philanthropic community, being a nonprofit leader in this community. I can tell you the number of donors who have reached out and said, we're waiting for a plan. We want to know how to support these issues collaboratively, from school districts to philanthropists to parents. People are waiting on us to come up with a plan to address these issues.
And Ken, I got to ask, when you come out with a report on this, is it greeted with polite nods, or are you getting calls from legislative staffers, from policymakers?
So we have not fielded any calls from people at the state level yet. We are sharing this report with them now, and they are they're probably, hopefully, digesting it and will be asking their questions soon. But we do need assistance from people in the media to keep this on people's radar screen. So when, you know, when we're talking with African-American audiences, they're saying, you know, there is no new news here. Yeah. This has been my lived experience for a long time. You're not telling me anything I don't already know. But when we talk with folks, particularly white folks across the state, this really is shocking. This really is new, and this really is not understood. And that's going to take a while, and we're going to need to keep this drumbeat. But like Michael said, we have to quickly transition from talking to action.
That's real.
Michael, briefly before the news, that talking about gaps, is there an understanding gap between the black and white communities in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, black people that's impacted by this data, like I said, they're not surprised about it because they're living it every single day. And I'll tell you, when I talk to some of my white friends, those are close to me, they know about it if they're tied to the work. But if you live in a middle-class community and you don't see this work and you're not involved in it, some people are actually shocked by some of this data because they're not connected to it.
We're talking to Ken Taylor of the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families and Michael Johnson of the Dane County Boys and Girls Club. Report came out today showing Wisconsin is dead last in the nation when it comes to the well-being of African-American children.
We're taking your calls on this. Why do you think Wisconsin does so poorly when it comes to minority children, particularly African-American children? And how do you see this playing out in your community? What do you think Wisconsin should do to change the problem? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to talk at WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about the state of minority children in Wisconsin with Ken Taylor, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families, and Michael Johnson, CEO of the Dane County Boys and Girls Club.
We're taking your calls. Why do you think Wisconsin is doing the worst in the country when it comes to the well-being of African-American children? What do you think needs to change in our state to make things more equal for all kids? What do you see in your community? What are you doing in your community when it comes to addressing these problems? Call in at 800-642-1234, or you can email talk at WPR.org. We'll go straight to our callers now. We've got Cindy on the line in Appleton. Cindy, hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm just wondering how the voucher system is going to play into this, and I also wish you would speak to the fact that in Wisconsin we have a very high disproportionate African-American to whites in prison, and I'm sure that must play a role.
Wow, two huge issues there. Let's take them one at a time. Voucher schools offered as an alternative in communities of Milwaukee and Racine originally. Ken, let's start with you.
Well, that's a very tricky question. There's a lot very complex set of issues at play there. From the read that I have of the literature, we haven't seen improved outcomes for kids who are in voucher schools compared to those in the public schools. We do know that investing in kids helps, and we do know that we have some challenges in that. I don't know that the voucher schools have been the solution that people had hoped. We have a lot of work to do on education, and it's a lot of things that contribute to this that are outside of the schoolhouse that we also need to look at. It's not just pinning the education challenges on the schools, whether they're public or private.
Michael, your thoughts on various kinds of school choice as an option to improve the disparity?
Yeah, so I'm pro public schools, but I'm pro public schools and ensuring that our kids get the results that they need. I also think it's good for a parent to have options. So if you are a middle-class person, you could decide whether or not you want to send your kids to private schools or public schools. But if you live in a poor neighborhood, a young mother or a two-household family won't have those options. So I do believe kids deserve options in terms of where they parents deserve options to where they want to send their schools. In terms of the disparities around prison, you look at here in Dane County, where we're at, the last report that Ken and his group put out, 47% of African-American young men between the ages of 25 are either in jail, probation, or parole. That was at the time the same exact graduation rate of African-American boys. So if you want to stop that school-to-prison pipeline, we have to stop suspending African-American boys. We have to make sure that they're coming to school. We have to make sure they get the training that they need, employ them, and keep them out the criminal justice system.
Yeah, and I would just add to what Michael said that the criminal justice system, both the juvenile justice system and the adult justice system, Wisconsin really is a national outlier with the amount of interaction that our residents have, particularly residents of color, have with the justice system, in sometimes 3, 4, 5 times the national rates. Just for an example, we lock up twice as many people proportionally as Minnesota does. And so I think that this is something that has bipartisan interest in addressing from no matter where you sit on the political spectrum. People are looking at it from a moral perspective and a cost perspective. It's not effective, and it's something that we need to take a good hard look at in our state.
Cindy, thanks for bringing up those issues. We'll go to Mark now in Fort Atkinson. Mark, hi.
Hi. Hi, I'm my son was a teacher in the Milwaukee school districts for 2 years, and when I was went back to school late, and I observed in the Milwaukee schools for my pre-student teaching, and I'm my family's originally from Milwaukee, so I know the history of Milwaukee, and I know that Wisconsin has traditionally been an industrial state. Well, this is becoming less and less so, and it's hard to give people jobs when there are no jobs. These people need gainful employment. They need to have a light in their eyes when they're walking down the street. The children need to come home to homes where dads come home from a hard day's work so they can see some kind of an ethic, and they just don't see it anymore. There's a look of hopelessness in the faces of people that as they're walking down the streets in Milwaukee. And it's
Marka, thanks a lot for the call. I want to get our guests in on this. It's almost a vicious circle. There's no jobs. That makes it hard to raise a family. That bad family situation leads to problems getting jobs in the future. It just keeps going around and around. Ken, you want to start off on that?
Yeah, so I agree with Mark that jobs are one of the keys. Michael was talking about having the audacious goal of having the same job rate for people of color as for whites in our state. I would add to that that the jobs need to be family supporting jobs. That it's important to have a job, but there are too many people in our state and too many families who are struggling, even though they're working full time or working multiple jobs. So. And that becomes, you know, he's talking about a vicious cycle, but it can turn around and be an upward cycle, you know, that we're a consumer-driven economy. And so once we get dollars into the pockets of these folks, they spend it, and it creates an upward cycle. So we need to think bigger picture on this. Yeah.
So I'll tell you, I grew up in poverty. I'm 38, stayed in public housing. For 25 of those years, and I watched my family, generation after generation, be on public assistance. I think when you look at W-2, it's a good program, but it also hurts a lot of family in poverty. Quick example, young lady I know in this community, went got her had four kids, went got a bachelor's degree, went got a master's degree, got off W-2, went got a $40,000 a year job. What she lost was her housing subsidy. She lost her food subsidy. She lost her child care subsidy. So then the question becomes, do I work or do I stay dependent on the state and federal government? So we have to figure out how do we incentivize people to work so they don't become dependent on state and federal resources. Then how do we get our businesses to hire people of color? There's times I go into companies that will have 200, 300, 400 people, and you will not see one person of color working in their facilities. And so we have to change that if we're going to change some of these numbers.
Go to Ian in Milwaukee now. Ian, hi, you're on the air.
We've been throwing money at this problem the same way since the Johnson administration. And it's not the schools, it's not the teachers, it's not the kids. We need to take care of the parents need to make this a priority in their home. And unfortunately, we may have to just legislate it that if your kids aren't getting C's or better, then you're going to have to start spending school in time with them. We just keep doing the same thing over and over again.
Gotcha, Ian. Michael, do you want to start off on this one?
Yeah, you hear that argument, you know, all the time. And I respect that he called in. I absolutely agree with him that parents have to be involved. But what I would challenge him to think about is, what about that single mother who may be underemployed and she's working two jobs? There's a perception from some of my white friends that black people don't want to work. And I see so many of the mothers that I deal with every day, they are underemployed. They're working two, maybe three jobs and may not have that time to come to school and spend time with their child in school. When I was a kid growing up, I remember my mother tell me, my mother did not like coming to the school. And she said, if I have to come up to your school, I'm coming with a belt. So I knew Michael Johnson better behave in school because I did not want to see my mother up there because she was busy. Now, to his credit, there are some parents that can be doing a lot more to get involved in their lives. But I don't want to generalize that all parents are like that.
One more call from Helen in Ottawa. Helen, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I would actually like to shadow some of his comments that he just said, that it, you know, it takes a community. For the prior caller about, you know, pushing parents to have Cs, yes, we do need to have parents, but those parents that are out there doing this, you know, they have their own issues. What I called in to say in the first place was, is here Milwaukee is one of the highest segregated cities in all of the U.S., and I can't speak to why that is, but that's the truth of it. So with that, you have the city that was industrialized and had jobs. The industrialization went away. The jobs that were paying people, you know, that had the hands-on skills went away. And now you have these people that don't have jobs. The jobs that are out there, there's no pay for it. How can somebody support a family on $7-something an hour?
Helen, thanks. We've talked a little bit about the jobs issue, the segregation issue in Milwaukee. I've heard similar things about Madison. Ken?
Right, and that is a real challenge, and it appears that it's getting worse before it's getting better, which is one of the reasons why we need to develop relationships across geographies, across races, and we need to go out of our way to do it in a more integrated community. It happens more naturally just walking down the street. In many places in our state and in our country, that's not something that necessarily naturally happens. So we need to go out of our way to develop these relationships, to really develop our understanding so that the solutions work for everyone.
And Michael, I want to give you the last word. Is it realistic to hope Wisconsin is going to make changes and make these numbers I'm looking at a little better?
So I'll say I just want to answer one part of that last question. I'm going to say that we went from segregated schools to segregated school districts and communities, and it's all tied to the area codes that you live in. So we have to take a look at that. Wisconsin is a great state, and if we're going to be a better state, we have to address these issues, and I think we have to do it through policies. We have to invest more in public education. We need a big, bold plan. Both the Republican and the Democratic candidates for governor need to both be talking about this issue and need to communicate how they're going to help address it. And if we don't put that plan in place, if we don't put resources in place, we will be talking about these issues in years to come.
We'll leave it there. Michael, thanks for joining us in the studio.
Thank you.
And Ken, thanks for coming up here as well.
Thanks for having us.
We've been hearing from Ken Taylor, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families, and Michael Johnson, CEO of the Dane County Boys and Girls Club, here with us to discuss a new report showing Wisconsin last in the nation for the well-being of African-American children. All right, Veronica, this is the age of the digital download. Do you still have your CD collection?
What I have is a bunch of CDs rattling around my car in various stages of gouges and scratches. And if I want to hear one, I really want to hear one. I hope to God that it's not one of the gouged or scratched ones.
It doesn't skip repeatedly. Yeah, I listen pretty much just in the car. I've got the collection. I've got the CD player. They're mostly dust collectors in the house. You too?
Pretty much.
Well, we're speaking blasphemy to our next guest. We have Stephen Hayden with us. He's based in Appleton. He's a contributing writer for Grantland, where he wrote a piece on the case for CDs. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, a lot of people are not paying attention to their CDs, even giving up their collections in favor of listening online. Not you. Tell us about your CD collection.
Well, I truly am a sick man. I would guess in the neighborhood of like 5,000 CDs.
Wow.
Going back to, you know, I started buying CDs when I was 14 and I'm 37 now. And, I still buy CDs. That's my preferred way of buying music. I mean, I still will, you know, get downloads and I buy vinyl records and, I stream music and all that, but I still like the CD format, and I'm sure it's partly nostalgia, but I also do think that there are inherent qualities to the format that I like that has kept me buying discs.
Yeah, tell us about some of those qualities, because I've heard of fanatical devotion to vinyl. I haven't yet heard this argument made for CDs, so what do you think CDs have going for them?
Well, when we talk about, you know, the vinyl era, you know, talking about the 60s and 70s and 80s. Artists back then made records knowing that they were going to be on vinyl records, and that ended up influencing the type of records that they made. So, for instance, albums back then tended to be between 30 and 40 minutes. You know, people would think in terms of like LP sides, you know, so they would, you know, construct the track listing to fall a certain way. And then when CDs came about, that similarly influenced the art, like the physical format influenced the art. So, you know, one example of that would be that in the 90s, you had exploding, like, running times. Like, albums got to be really long. And sometimes, you know, they'd do like 16 to 18 tracks and push, you know, the 80-minute mark. And, you know, that's not necessarily a good thing for a lot of artists. However, there are a lot of records from that time that I think did utilize that format really well. You know, they would create these albums that were like immersive experiences where, you know, there'd be hidden tracks and skits and like interstitial material connecting the tracks. And I would argue that for albums like that, the CD format works really well, and just in a similar way that certain albums maybe work better on vinyl.
Are there a couple albums that work particularly well for you that it feels wrong to listen to them any other way?
Well, I think that there's a lot of rap records from that era that, like, work better on CD. Like, you know, like the first De La Soul record, yep. 2 Feet High and Rising. There's a lot of skits on that record. And, you know, you can obviously stream 3 Feet High and Rising, or you can listen to it, you know, on MP3s or whatever. But, you know, if you have the option to skip skits, I think most people will take that option. You know, they're just going to go right to the songs that they like. And, you know, obviously you can listen to music any way you want to, but I think that there is something to be said for appreciating the album as it was made by the creators. And the CD format, I think, makes that a little bit easier.
I appreciate that point, and I don't want to be a bummer, but I keep reading that CDs are kind of doomed, that they're degrading rapidly, more rapidly than other mediums for listening to music. Are you worried that your CD collection is sort of crumbling under your feet?
Well,
sorry.
Know, but, well, you know, we're all crumbling, you know?
That's true.
We're all falling apart.
That's
so
deep.
You know, I think that at some point in the very far future, you know, I will die and my CDs will still be here, and hopefully someone will be around to take them from me. But no, but you know, you're right. And also, there's not just the fact that, you know, CDs can break down. There's the fact that CD sales are plummeting each year. And at some point, you got to think that we're not going to be producing CDs anymore. It's just not going to be financially smart to do it. You know, one of the points in my story was the fact that, you know, we talk about the vinyl revival, like more people are buying vinyl records now, you know, after a time when people thought that vinyl was going to be, you know, basically extinct. And CDs don't have the same cachet as vinyl. You know, they're not as, you know, they're not as considered a sexy thing to collect for music fans. But I want to stick up for CDs because I think there is something to them that, makes them fun to collect. And if I'm the last person that is buying CDs, then so be it.
Stephen, good luck with your collection, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
That's Stephen Hayden of Appleton. He's a staff writer for Grantland.